Okay, thank you very much, Paul. As I mentioned before, this is AC2GS. My name is Roy. I am net control operator for this, the Limar Technical Net. This technical net has been going on since 1982, mostly under the sponsorship, the tutelage, the brilliance of Dick, K2RIW, who has since become a silent key, but we continue it in his memory. As always, I like to remind everyone that if you have any questions for the technical net, you can't get onto the radio, or you have any topics you'd like to hear discussed, or if you have any puzzles for me, I'm always looking for puzzles, or if you'd like me to tap Paul on the shoulder and ask him to take a look at some video, YouTube, website about space and say what he thinks of it, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. I have a link page. There is a link to an image that Paul will be discussing during his SpaceNet report. There are some YouTubes and videos that I mentioned last week that's part of a puzzle, and other things will develop on that. So you go to roy.ac2gs.com, and that's the link page. If you're interested in hanging out in our chat room, you could either go via the club's website, or you could just type into your browser chat.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring you to the chat room. And as always, I'm streaming this, hopefully, on the Internet. All you have to do is type in technet.ac2gs.com, and if you don't have access any other way, you can listen to the audio stream. And as I always like to remind people, Mike, KC2NJI, has a great website in which he's archived the technical nets that go back to September of 2006, and that's located at his website, amateurradio.tv. So those are the things to keep in mind. Let me drop for a sec, and I will move on with the TechNet. Okay, my plans for tonight, as per usual, we will open and ask for any questions of a technical nature, any topics to discuss, and we'll ask people to give their first name and their call sign, and we'll put them on the list. Sometime between 8:30 and 9 o'clock, we will have another episode of the very popular Andy's Corner. He will be discussing transmission lines and methods of doing impedance matching using transmission lines. So that should be interesting. Then I'll come back and we'll discuss any other little questions or topics anyone has. And at approximately 10:15, Paul will come for the space report. Now, don't set your atomic clock on that 10:15. That's an approximation. This technical net has always been approximation. We finish when we're done, and not earlier or later. So keep that in mind. So that's the plan for tonight. If anyone wants to ask any questions or bring up any topics, please give me your first name and your call sign.
This is K2GJE, Ed. I have a question.
WHYY, Joe, yes.
Bridge W2BZ, just listening.
KD2NFJ with a question.
KD2UDU, just reporting.
Okay, very good. We have three people with questions tonight, and if any other questions develop, we'll be taking them off and on through most of the technical net. So first on the list here tonight is Ed, K2GJE. What's your question for tonight, Ed?
Good evening. I've heard this term mentioned, Raspberry Pi. Is that a company? Is it hardware? Is it software, etc.? What is it over?
Okay, it is hardware. It is a very small, very inexpensive, but in every generation it grows more powerful computer. You can run programs on it. You can't run Windows per se, or you could run maybe a very crippled version of Windows. Often people use some flavor of Linux to run a program. It has pins so that you can plug in accessory boards. They're sometimes called hats. And what's very popular among hams is these hotspots, which are very often Raspberry Pis, and they put a hotspot, they put a hat on it that has UHF receiving and transmission capability, and they turn it into a hotspot. So a lot of the hotspots that we see are basically Raspberry Pis plus a little hardware and a little software. So basically, it's a hardware. It's a small, efficient, and cost-effective computer. There have been more than a few generations. I think they're up to Raspberry Pi 4s. As time goes on, they build in better, faster chipsets and more features like USB 3 and video output and all kinds of fun stuff. It's a great toy to play with. If you have nothing else to do, you know, getting one is very inexpensive. There's a lot of material on the internet about it, magazine articles written about it. So it's a fun little thing to work with.
2BZ.
Yes, Rich.
Wondering if he was asking it in terms of using a hotspot for digital radio as we...
Okay, Rich asks, and I'll pass it on to Ed. Were you thinking of it in terms of the talk of people with hotspots, or were you just generically talking about you've read bits and pieces of articles about the Raspberry Pi and you were curious?
No, I was just interested in what it is, and I've yet to investigate it. I guess I haven't had time to look on the internet. Can it be used like, let's say, as a computer to turn your outside house lights on when you're not home, or things like that, over?
Yes, you can use it for a lot of different things. As I mentioned, you can load up, if you're familiar with Linux, is an operating system that PC can load up a version of Linux, and it has a desktop. You could use a mouse with it. You could use it as a kind of very, very, very inexpensive computer that's not compatible with Windows software. But you could write programs, little scripts, because it has input and output lines, and you can have it do different things depending upon the state of the I/O line. So you can have timers go off and turn things on via relays and all kinds of fun stuff. People have written books on the subject of little projects you could put together with Raspberry Pis.
K2GJE, I was thinking of it more like something called a programmable controller. The way they wire machines now, it's very easy for the programmer and very easy for the electrician. They don't wire a switch to a light. They wire the power to the controller. They wire the switch to the controller. They wire the light to the controller. And they tell her what to do when it has to do something, over.
Yes, I mean, both industrially and home automation, that people keep on trying to promote home automation systems, and there's a whole bunch of different protocols available. There's the old X10 that I think came out in the 70s that was very sensitive to background noise and other problems, and then they had Insteon, which is a sort of an upgrade, and then they had Insteon that was both driven with sending pulses in the power connections and by sending RF signals simultaneously, and there is Z-Wave and a few others. I think a Raspberry Pi, although you could use it for something like that, is a bit overkill. There are simpler devices that are capable of handling things like that. There are other types of embedded systems. PIC was big at one point, and I know Ed WB2EAV has worked with PIC chips. I have a CW device that uses a PIC chip. So you don't quite need something as powerful, but you could do it.
Thanks for the information. I'll let you go on to the next customer, over.
Okay, you're welcome, Ed. If anyone else out there has any comments, questions, answers, or point of view regarding Raspberry Pis, please give me your name and call sign.
WB2KWC.
Yes, Cam.
Okay, you had commented that Raspberry Pi might be overkill for working switches and things. I think as you add intelligence to them, you know, telling them to do things like, oh, turn on my lights 10 minutes before sundown, turn on my, or disable my lawn sprinkler if I have more than a half inch of rain, then you need something as intelligent as a Pi to do those type of functions.
Well, yeah, I would agree with you, Ken. It's a matter of degree. It, you know, it's sort of what you really want. If you just want something to kind of get a signal and latch a relay and turn a light on or off or what have you, then I think if, you know, even the original Raspberry Pi is a wee bit overpowered for that. You could use it for it. If you have a very, very intricate, esoteric plan where a bunch of different devices are going to affect the response to other devices, then things get more complicated, and certainly a Raspberry Pi becomes a more obvious option. It's just that, you know, if my Insteon devices that I put into my switch boxes are incredibly primitive design. You know, they're nowhere near a Raspberry Pi. I have a controller that kind of organizes them from a separate access point. That might be approximately up to the level of a Raspberry Pi, but I bought it long before there were Raspberry Pis, so I don't exactly know what small processor chip is running it. But yeah, there's nothing against using a Raspberry Pi for somewhat limited purposes. You can do that. I mean, I once saw in a book that I have that you can get an on-the-air detector that runs on a Raspberry Pi, and basically you could remove the entire Raspberry Pi and replace it with a small solid-state relay switch, and the darn thing would work just as well, because there wasn't anything special with the Raspberry Pi, but you could use it. So I agree with you, Ken. Once again, this is AC2GS. My name is Roy, and this is the Limar Technical Net. If you have any other questions or comments about Raspberry Pis, you know, it's not really the point of this particular net, but it is a fascinating device, and it's certainly worth anyone who likes to tinker with computer systems and learn things. They're very inexpensive. And there's, like as I said before, there's loads and loads of material on the Internet for free that will kind of give you all kinds of great ideas of what to do with this.
Right, WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
How do you power them? You know, I know they're inexpensive. You can get them like $35. And do they come with a wall wart or something to plug in? Or just wondering about that. Or do you need your own 12-volt power supply? You got to tap into that.
Well, I mean, different people package them differently. All that you need is a USB-compatible power source. So the same thing that will charge any USB device will run a Raspberry Pi. So sometimes they do stock it with a wall wart with a USB connection at the end, and you plug the USB connection in, and that powers it up for you. You know, I guess there are lower-priced versions where they save a couple of bucks and tell you to use one of the... At this point, I think I have 20 wall warts that take USB connections.
Oh, okay, now USB is good. You know, I've got USB hubs here, you know, so I got plenty of spots to plug in. Very good, back to you.
Yeah, I mean, once again, I don't make any money off of advertising for any of this stuff, but it, you know, if you're a tinkerer, it's a 21st century tinkering thing. You know, we all remember having crystal radio sets, and it's sort of like a computer version of something like that for the 21st century. They're fascinating. They have a lot of ports. They have video out. You can hook up cameras as little door-to-board attachments and have it monitor the video around areas. It's an endless number of things. There's different hats that will record temperature and humidity and light. And if you can think of a detector, someone has built a hat that plugs into one of those Raspberry Pis. So, again, for tinkerers out there, especially tinkerers who want to get their feet wet a little bit with computer science, a Raspberry Pi is a very nice thing to have. Well, I think we've kind of walked around the subject of Raspberry Pis for tonight. Next on the list is Joe, W-A-2-R-Y-Y. What can I do for you tonight, Joe?
Good evening, Roy, W-A-2-R-Y-Y. I'm sure many of us have used a tuner cleaner to clean switches and other various contacts of the like. Here's the question. What do you do when you lose a little red tube that you normally attach to the side of the can with an adhesive tape? Anybody ever find a source for these things? Back to you.
Okay, that's a good question. What I tend to do is I save my little red tubes, because a lot of times people use the same sizes, or you can shave them down a little bit. If you are a fan, as I am, of canned ear, each of those have a tube. So, you know, it might fit, and worst comes to worst, it may be a little bit on the big side. You take out a little knife, and you do a little whittling, and you work it down. But offhand, that would be my kind of suggestion, but I'm open to hear if anyone else out there has any ideas of where you would go to replace the little tube that extends the point that you spray the lubricant.
KD2FIU.
Yes, George.
Good evening, Roy. Good evening, Joe. Cocktail straws. The ones with the hole in the center, the red ones. If it doesn't fit into the inner diameter of the nozzle of the spray head, take a little emery and fine it. Doesn't take much adjustment. The red cocktail straws. I think they come in bags of 50, 100, whatever.
Okay, thank you. That's a good idea as well, cocktail straws. So it sort of depends upon what other activities you tend to dither in. I have just canned ear. I don't have any cocktails, so I use what I got. But I would imagine you have canned ear. You strike me as the canned ear kind of guy.
Yeah, let me finish with that, Roy. Yeah, I do have a canned air. I forgot which brand it was, one of the more common ones. But what happens is with these straws, over the years, over 30 years or so, I've lost so many of them, whether it was for the WD-40, whether it was for my spray for cleaning contacts or whatever. I found that these cocktail straws were available in supermarkets, and they come in boxes, little boxes, 50 or 100 or whatever, and I picked up one box many, many years ago, and I still got some laying around. And like I said, you take emery to kind of like reduce the outer diameter of it to fit the head of the nozzle spray that you need to replace your straw for.
Okay, very good. Thank you, George. Chet wanted to add something. WA2AHK.
Okay, gentlemen. I was interested in that myself. How many times have I lost that darn thing? Oh, it's something that happens quite often. So anyway, I jumped up with my HK. I went into the bathroom, and underneath my sink, I took out the Q-tip company's box of Q-tips. And they have that little white handle and the two cotton pieces on the end. I took my sharp scissors and I lopped off the cotton on both ends. And sure enough, it's hollow. And it looks like it'll fit.
So, okay, that's an interesting thing. Are your Q-tips the tubes paper or are they plastic?
I'll take a look here. I just dropped it on the floor. Yeah. I know that you're going to say they won't last very long, but you only really need it to have a squirt or two. There's plenty of Q-tips. All right, I have it in my hand. It's hard to tell. It could be very hard paper. I'm not sure. But it could be a plastic. So maybe people could try it. And I'm going to try this tomorrow because I have one or two missing ones and things that I have in the garage. So this might be just what the doctor ordered.
Okay, very good, Chet. I'm trying to think if I ever saw anything like this in QST's Hints and Kinks, because it certainly would belong there, but thank you. So, Joe, you have the suggestion from George, the cocktail straws. You have Chet's comments, and you have Q-tips, and my thought on candy air. If anyone else has any good ideas, please share them. Okay, very good. So I think we gave you, hopefully we gave you some ideas to deal with this problem. Do you think these are workable solutions, Joe?
I don't know. Have to check it out and look into it and see if the applications will fit. Thanks. W2YY.
You're welcome. Okay, let me go on to our third person with a question, Sam. You checked in earlier. What's your question for tonight?
Thank you, Roy. KD2NSJ. Roy, I was talking to George about my Yaesu 8900R, and he got a new radio, and I said, oh, George, maybe we can talk on 10 meter. And he explained to me that my 10 meter is FM and his 10 meter is HF. And I never realized there was a difference.
Well, Sam, it's not exactly that his is HF. You have to appreciate the fact that our communications are kind of based on two things. One is the frequency, so that's why, you know, you talk about 80 meters and 40 meters and 20 meters and 10 meters. 10 meters is 28 megahertz and up. But also mode. Mode is very important. You can communicate via CW. You can communicate via phone. Phone could be either FM, as in your radio, or amplitude modulated, AM, or in the case of what I think George was telling you, single sideband. Most people tend to operate single sideband on the voice of 10 meters. And so you would need a radio that was capable of transmitting, modulating, and demodulating single sideband transmission. FM would be okay for some, repeaters that are on 10 meters that tend to be FM, and there are people who use FM modulation, but most of the activity on the phones on 10 meters are single sideband.
Okay, I don't want to sound so, I don't know. But who can I talk to on my 6 meter or 10 meter?
That's a good question. You can look up to see if there are any 10 meter repeaters. Occasionally they show up. Sometimes they're actually working. So sometimes they're linked to 2 meters or 70 centimeters. So I would take a quick look at the repeater book to see if there's anything in your area and try that out. I'd be interested if anyone, offhand, I don't know if there is an FM calling frequency for 10 meters that is within the technician band. If there is someone, please let me know.
WP2AHK.
Frequency on 10 meters, calling frequency is 29.6. And what is the tech band, 28.3 to 28.5? Or has that been changed over the years? WB2BXL.
No, I think it's the same. Chad also wanted to say something?
Yeah, I was just on 10 meters about 20 minutes ago with WB2HBR. I wanted to do a test. I haven't been on 20 meters in 30 years. Never ran my rig, my HF rig on FM either. And I asked them what, I went there, the 29600. He asked me to do a FM check with him. And I asked him, what frequency is this? And he says, that's the national call-in frequency. And you use that to see if anybody's around. And once you find somebody, you name a frequency and you move away from that channel. So it looks like 29600 is the place to go.
Okay, thanks, Chet. But I think there's a little bit of a problem. Unless I'm mistaken, Sam has a technician's license, and that's totally out of the technician's frequency range.
Yes, Roy, that's what George told me also. I realized I'm getting ready to try to take the test. Yeah, I have a check, and they showed it when I looked at the frequency thing, and they show you what area you can't go into. But at least I understand much clearer, Roy, than George said also. Roy, thank you. And I did download a couple of repeaters that was on 10 meters, and there was one on 6 meters in Planet. So I'm going to try that. But thank you very much. I'm not disappointed. I learned.
Okay, very good, Sam. You have an amateur radio's attitude about it. You know, these things are not detrimental. They're learning experiences. And as far as I am aware, technicians have access to 28 megahertz to 28.5 megahertz. That's the only portion that they have access to. But I'm sure if you apply yourself, Sam, you can get a general exam. I know that you could do it if you put your mind to it. So I wish you good luck, Sam.
Yeah, I'm ready for it. Thank you, Roy. KD2NFJ.
Okay, very good. Instead of asking for more questions at this point, I'll turn the technical net over to Andy for Andy's Corner. I'll be back after he's done, and we can talk about any other questions or if people want to play with some of the puzzles that I offered them last week. So, Andy, WA2CDL, are you there?
Yes, I am here. Thank you, Roy, WA2CDL. And, Roy, just before I go on, how are you hearing the repeater? Because it looks like it's coming in a lot weaker over here, signal strength-wise, on my service monitor. Are you hearing it okay?
I'm hearing it reasonably okay. In the good old days when I had a whole bunch of antennas, I could tell you exactly how many dBm it was being received, but the days of multiple antennas are not here right now, so I'm just looking at it with my IC7100, and it doesn't really give you much in the way of signal strength. But, you know, it's a good, strong sound. I don't hear any background noise, so it's working for me.
Okay, because it's coming in here minus 78 dBm, and usually I get it around minus 70. So that's a big drop, and nothing has changed over here. All right, just wanted to get an idea because I just noticed it. So, all right, good evening to everyone listening to Andy's Corner, and we are going to be continuing our discussions that we've been talking about for the past few weeks. And this is basically from an article that I've taken out of QST, and it's about impedance matching. And in this particular case, because we can match impedances many different ways, but this particular article in QST refers to impedance matching using transmission lines, which is a very interesting way of doing it. And I thought to bring everybody up to date, before we go into how to match impedances with transmission lines, we'll talk about what is a transmission line, what it does, how it works, and so on. So the past 2 weeks, we've been talking about that. And unfortunately, there's a lot of diagrams and illustrations that these articles refer to, and it's hard to get away from those. So I'm gonna have to sort of finagle my way around here to try to explain it, so you can get a visualization of what we're talking about. You know, it's too bad that we could do this on a Zoom thing. We can actually see what's going on a blackboard. But I'll do my best with this because it is an interesting topic, and us all being hams, you know, we're matching impedances all the time, or at least we're trying to. We're trying to get our signal out. So we'll give it a shot. Any questions up to this point as far as the work that we've been covering these past few weeks regarding this? Anybody have any questions? WA2CDL. Okay, well, in a way that's good because my memory is not that great and I don't have to look up all the answers, which are not at my fingertips. So what I'm going to do is basically read. And this is from a different, it's a short discussion, or I should say bite-sized discussion that I've been giving on transmission lines and how they work and so on. So last week we covered standing wave ratio, you know, what is SWR and how is it measured. So I think I'll just go over that again to bring everybody up to date and as a refresher, because, you know, from here on in, it gets a little bit complicated, and again, with all the illustrations that I'm seeing, I have to explain them as well as talk about them, so bear with me on that, and we'll see how this works. So, we were talking about standing wave ratio last week, and Again, as I mentioned last week, the extent of the mismatch between the line and the termination is indicated by the ratio of the maximum to the minimum value of voltage along the line. So you can look at, along your transmission line, you have a voltage that's generated from your transmitter, and it goes along the coax cable and out the other end, and hopefully is terminated in a load that matches the line. And the line is called a characteristic impedance or surge impedance, and the load is the load impedance. And maximum, from a previous discussion, maximum power transfer occurs in theory and in practicality also, that when the load is matched to the when the source is matching the load. So and that's what you want, because you want the maximum power reaching your termination, whether it be a terminated line in a 50 ohm load or an antenna. Because obviously you want your signal to go to the antenna as much as possible with the best efficiency. By the way, I'm hearing static again. Just to let everybody know. So as I just said, the extent of the mismatch between the line and the termination is indicated by the ratio.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Yeah, I have a tendency to time out, so bear with me. WA2CDO. Okay, so I got to remind myself. So it's the ratio of the maximum value to the minimum value of voltage along the line. Okay, so the ratio can also be given for current, but as I mentioned last week, we normally refer to SWR as VSWR, which is voltage standing wave ratio. We don't refer to current standing wave ratio, but we could. And it says right here, this voltage standing wave ratio, however, is more common than using current. So we use VSWR. And there's a formula which we use for figuring out how to find the voltage standing wave ratio, which is usually abbreviated VSWR on the line. And that is, again, as I just said, it's your voltage max divided by your voltage minimum. And they actually show an illustration of what it looks like here. So it's going to be hard to describe it. It's just a waveform, and they show you where the peaks, where the voltage max is and where the voltage min is, minimum and maximum. So as an example, and again, I'm going over this because we did this last week. If the minimum voltage along a transmission line is 2 volts and the maximum voltage is 4 volts, the standing wave ratio is 4, which is the max, divided by 2, which is the min, which is 2. So now you have a 2 to 1, because it's a ratio of 2 to 1. That's what your SWR is. Now, a standing wave ratio of 2 indicates that the load resistance is either twice as high as the impedance of the cable, or characteristic impedance of the line, or one half as high. So which means that so if you have a 50 ohm line and you have a 100 ohm load, that'll give you a 2 to 1 SWR. And if anybody has a SWR meter and they put a 100 ohm load, put it across your line going through an SWR meter, you should see, if the SWR meter is calibrated properly, it's designed for the frequency, you should see approximately a 2 to 1 SWR with a 100 ohm load. Consequently, if the load is half the impedance, so if you have a 50 ohm line and you put a 25 ohm load in, it's also 2 to 1. So it says here the standing wave ratio of 2 indicates...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Okay, I talk too much, but that's okay. Let me get the beep. okay, because I missed it. The steady wave ratio of 2 indicates that the load resistance is either twice as high as the characteristic impedance of the line or one half as high. So if the load resistance is on the high side of the characteristic impedance, the voltage loop, you know, as the voltage maximum, would be located at the termination. With the load resistance, see now it depends on the load resistance, if it's either higher or lower than the resistance of the line. The coax cable is the line, by the way. So if the load resistance is on the high side of the impedance, the voltage loop would be located at the termination. With the load resistance lower than the impedance of the line, the voltage minimum and current maximum will be present at the termination. See, that's a little bit hard to digest, you know, why it's at the termination. So, as I mentioned last week, the amplitude of the steady wave of voltage on the line depends on the impedance mismatch between the characteristic impedance of the line and the load. So, in other words, we're measuring it at the termination. So, if you do a measurement point and if you see the maximum and minimum, you'll see that if the impedance is either higher or lower, you'll see that the voltage will be either higher or lower, as I just mentioned. Let me let it drop. So, therefore, you can also use the ratio of the impedance of the line to the load resistance to compute the voltage steady wave ratio. If the load resistance is larger than the surge impedance, okay, there's a formula, and if you want to write this down, you can compute the VSWR by using the following formula, and that is VSWR equals RL, which is the load resistance, divided by the impedance of the line, which is known, characterized by ZO. Z is the impedance. So it's RL over ZO, and the Z is the impedance of the coax cable. So consequently, if the load resistance is smaller than the surge impedance, then what you do is you just take the reciprocal of that formula and you flip it around. Instead of it being RL over ZO, it's now ZO over RL. So it's just the opposite. So in other words, you're going to have, instead of a maximum voltage, you have a minimum voltage. And whenever the voltage is minimum, the current is at maximum along the line. So you have the maximum current and minimum voltage, or maximum voltage and minimum current. And it's again, the illustration shows that here that I'm looking at. So, let me let it drop. Suppose the load resistance is 50 ohms and the line impedance is 150 ohms. Now, this is interesting because since the load resistance is smaller than the line impedance, we should use the second formula, which is the impedance of the line, that's the coax cable, divided by the load resistance. So now, it's 150 ohms, because the line impedance is 150 ohms, divided by 50, which is the load impedance. Now you'll have an SWR of 3, or 3 to 1, because it's a ratio. The measurement of the steady wave ratio along the transmission line is a reliable method for determining whether or not the load impedance is matched correctly to the transmission line. The absolute value of the steady wave ratio indicates the seriousness of the mismatch. A low steady wave ratio indicates a slight mismatch, while a high steady wave ratio shows a serious mismatch. Again, I mentioned this last week, I'm just repeating it. And we're going into the last paragraph, and then we'll continue. The steady wave ratio and efficiency of a transmission line system can also be judged by comparing the incident and reflected powers. The incident power is the energy that is passing down the line from your transmitter to the load. The reflected power is the energy that is reflected back up the line from the termination because of the mismatch. An instrument referred to as a reflectometer can be used to compare the incident and reflected powers, thus giving an ideal indication of line efficiencies and power output. We let it drop. Okay, so, you know, reflectometer, you can call that SWR meter, you can call it whatever name you want to give it. So they refer to it as a reflectometer, and they say most television and FM transmitters use this method for checking transmitter output power and efficiency, which makes sense. As most people have heard of BIRD, B-I-R-D, they make watt meters, and they make high power watt meters that can measure up to, hold on a second, I want to see if I can dissipate the static. Okay, static cleared. It's playing with me. I don't like hearing the static because it's competing with me. Most broadcast stations use reflectometers, but they use a one made by BIRD, which can actually measure up to 50,000 watts or more. I've seen BIRD plugs that go up that high that are used in the broadcast industry. Okay, so we're going to talk a little bit about a reflectometer, so you'll know what it is. Will you let it drop again? And any questions up to this point, WA2CDO? Okay, all's quiet. Very good. All right, so a reflectometer. Okay, so a typical reflectometer is shown as a picture of it. It's actually composed of two pickup devices. One to measure the power in the incident wave, and the other to measure power in the reflected wave. The pickup devices in reflectometers used with high power transmitters are small coils of wire inside a shielded line. Let me see. It says, notice in the diagram that the two pickup devices are oppositely connected and located at the same position on the line. Electrically, both devices operate the same. Therefore, our discussion of the incident pickup device will also apply to the reflection device. So if you've ever opened up an SWR meter, and you'll see there's a section of line, and it's got some way of picking up the signal, either with a coil, sometimes there's a diode, there's a line section, and there's a diode connected to it. The diode then detects the RF signal, rectifies it, puts it into the meter, and it's located at the opposite ends of a length of line that's inside your SWR meter. I remember Dick has spoken about this. As far as the slugs of the BIRD watt meter, it's a BIRD watt meter can be called, I'm trying to think of the word, or referred to as a directional coupler, because that's what it does. And as you turn the slug around, you can measure your power in your forward direction, you measure your power in the reflected, in the reverse direction. And by measuring the power, then you compute the SWR, because the BIRD watt meter itself does not give you an SWR number. There's a nanogram Bird. All right, let me let it drop. W2CDO. All right, I'm going to try. Okay. That's the. I'm trying to see if I can get the static to disappear because it's really annoying. All right, so continuing our discussion of what a reflectometer is, the coil, which is usually a single turn, provides inductive coupling to the center conductor. Capacitive coupling is obtained from the spacing between the coil and the center wire. So there's a diagram that shows you how this pickup device works, how it picks up the signal. The voltage drop across R, which is a resistor, okay, from the capacitor coupling is proportional to the voltage between the center conductor and the shield. So what I'm going to do now is it's just giving a discussion of how this particular reflectometer is drawn out and how it picks up the signal. But it's mainly it's a coil that measures the inductive picks up the inductive field from the transmission line, and then there's a spacing between the coil and the and that conductor, which comprises of a capacitor. So that is the actual pickup device that is used in a reflectometer. All right, so I'm going to skip the next part here because it's just mainly saying what I'm saying now. All right, any questions up to this point? And then we'll go on to the next topic on this, WHCDL. All right. I'm just waiting for the static to dissipate because it's. All right. So the next topic actually is the heart of this discussion, because getting back to the QST article that I've been talking about, impedance matching with transmission lines. So we're going to use transmission lines to convert impedances. Now, we're going to actually take advantage of the standing waves that are on the line. And this is what the article is about, this next article that I'm going to discuss. And again, if you can follow along, I'll go slow to see if we can all understand it. Because this has to do with transmission lines as circuit elements. So let me just let it drop and I'll continue. Okay, so a section of transmission line can be made to act as a circuit element by taking advantage of the standing wave pattern along the line. You have learned that the input impedance of a transmission line is subject to wide variations along its length when it's not matched. In fact, the input impedance can be high or low, resistive or reactive, or a combination of combination of resistive and reactive components. Expressing the same thought differently, a transmission line can be made to act as a capacitor, an inductor, a resistor, or a combination of circuit components. It can also be made to have the characteristics of a series resonant or parallel resonant circuit. What the characteristics will be depends on the line length and the termination. So here you go. So we just mentioned that now we can make a transmission line act as a certain element, and it's that function which we use to match impedances using transmission lines, which is the discussion in the QST article. So, if a transmission line is cut to the correct length to correspond to an electrical half wavelength at the frequency of the generator, standing wave patterns such as those shown in my figure here occur. That is, of course, is a figure that we have to look at, and you have to see what a half wave looks like, and the currents and the voltages from the beginning of the line to the end of the line, which will be a half wave long. And the half wave, by the way, is 180 degrees. Quarter wave is 90 degrees, if you want to consider it that way. So when the line is open, and they show you here in the diagram, as in figure 12A, its open end constitutes a very high impedance. And a high impedance will cause zero current and a maximum volt at the maximum voltage point. So you'll have a minimum of current and a maximum voltage at the high impedance point. A half-wave dipole, by the way, is just the opposite.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Okay, W2CDL. I started to say a half-wave dipole at the center, at the feed point, always has a low impedance. Your high impedance is your voltage max, and your voltage max occurs at the ends of the line. Your current max is at the feed point of the dipole, and that's the characteristic of a half-wave dipole. And as most people know, or maybe you don't, I believe a dipole in free space has a characteristic impedance of around 70 ohms, 72 ohms, something around that number. And that's in free space. As the dipole is lowered closer to the ground, the impedance is going to go down, because now you're going to have ground effects. So there is a number of wavelengths that in it. For the dipole to give you maximum efficiency, and that should be a number of wavelengths above the ground. So, as I just said, when the line is open, its opened end constitutes a very high impedance. And in parentheses it says zero current and maximum voltage. That's a zero current and maximum voltage point. At voltage maximum, or voltage loop, as they call it, and a current minimum, or current node, so a voltage will be a loop and a current, as they call it, a node, also exists at the input. Thus, the generator sees, looking, if the generator could look into it, look into the line, it will see a high impedance. The half-wave leg line has repeated the open circuit impedance of the termination. So because it's a high impedance at the end of the line, voltage maximum, that's what your generator is going to see. This voltage and current wave along one line is shown above, and the waves on either line are shown below. So they have, these diagrams that show that you have a high impedance generator and a half wavelength away with an open circuited line. The line is open. You're going to see a high impedance at the. It reflects back to the generator, so it's showing it as a high impedance because that's the impedance at the opened end of the line. So as far as the generator is concerned, it's going to see a high impedance, and that's with the line open, with an open line. Okay, let me let it drop. W2CDL. Okay, now we're going to just do the opposite. We're going to short the end of the line. We're going to short what was open. Now we're going to short it. So now if the termination is shorted, and that's shown in this other diagram, the opposite standing wave condition develops. In this case, the termination is a short circuit and has an extremely low impedance. So obviously, if you think about it, if you short something out, you're lowering the impedance, right? If you take a resistor, and a resistor has a certain resistance, you short out the resistor, you're going to lower the resistance. So if you short out the line, you're going to have a low impedance. So in this case, the termination is a short circuit and has an extremely low impedance. A half-wave line, so a half-wave length away, again, repeats the impedance at the input, so that the generator works into a very low, short-circuited impedance. So now the generator, or your transmitter, is going to see a very low impedance looking into the line. The waves on one line are shown above. Okay, they're showing the waves. Let me let it drop. Roy, could you do me a favor?
Yeah, sure. What do you want?
I want to make sure this is not me that's generating all this static. Just transmit for about 5 seconds. Don't talk, just transmit. Okay, It's on you too. I just wanted to make sure. All right, because it's very annoying. I'm supposed to be going up to the antenna at the repeater this week. I hope to take a look and see what's going on. I want to get to the bottom of this. So please bear with me with all this stuff. All right, so as I just mentioned about the impedances, the line being open as opposed to the line being shorted a half wavelength away, does everybody understand that and see it the way I'm explaining it? Any questions? WA2CDO.
And the